from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The Senate is set to vote this hour on a bill to keep the government funded through February 8th. After Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told Democrats he intends to take up legislation on border security and protections for young undocumented immigrants. The vote comes after a bipartisan group of senators failed to reach an agreement last night. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of federal employees are furloughed today as the government remains closed for the third day. Coming up on our weekly political roundup, we'll get the latest on the shutdown and we'll discuss the big turnout for Women's March protests in the Bay Area and across the country on Saturday. That's all coming up after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The U.S. Senate is voting as we speak on a continuing resolution to reopen the government and keep it funded through February 8th. The vote comes after intense negotiations late last night among a bipartisan group of senators failed to yield a deal. At issue are Democrats' demands that the bill include provisions for DREAMers, undocumented immigrants who arrived in the United States as children. During a floor speech last night, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he intended to bring up legislation to protect DREAMers from deportation, an offer that appears to have created a way around the impasse. We'll talk about the vote, the effects of the shutdown, which is now in its third day, and the prospects for comprehensive immigration reform. And we're discussing the vote this morning to reopen and fund the government and its implications with Dan Schnur, who joins us here in studio, professor at the Annenberg School of Communications at USC and UC Berkeley, and a former Republican strategist who is now a registered independent. Welcome, Dan Schnur. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you back here. Also glad to have with us Christina Bellantoni. She's assistant managing editor for politics with the Los Angeles Times, and we welcome you to the program, Christina Bellantoni.
Thanks so much. Glad to be on.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Christina Greer, who joins us. She's a fellow at the NYU McSilver Institute. She's also associate professor of political science at Fordham and the author of Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. And welcome, Christina Greer.
Thank you.
Glad to have you, and we will have Jonah Goldberg with us later on in the program after the half hour, senior editor for the National Review and columnist for the LA Times and USA Today. And let me begin with Christina Bellantoni, who again is assistant managing editor for politics with the LA Times. And, well, the first year of Trump's administration, we have a shutdown, and we have, and we'll probably keep you up to date with this as much as we can hear during this present moment when we're going to be possibly hearing a deal made. What's the likelihood of that deal being made, as you see it, Christina?
So there is a deal.
Oh, there is a deal. All right. Well,
just as we were waiting to start the show, Democrats are saying they will vote to reopen the government in the next half an hour or so. In fact, several Democrats are saying the government will be reopened by 12:15 Eastern time, which is totally not possible because the House still needs to vote on this deal. But what it is it's a temporary government funding deal to keep the government funded through February 8th. Now, that's, again, sort of the root of the problem of all of these short-term spending measures, but the reason Democrats are voting for this is because they got assurances from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that there will be a vote to address the DREAM Act before that February 8th deadline and that they will be able to have a debate on immigration issues. Now, that doesn't mean anything will pass, but at least they will have the chance to address the issue. So Democrats are coming out and saying, in fact, one senator told reporters, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you get what you need. He didn't sing, but it's kind of relevant to me because that's one of the songs that President Trump will play at his campaign rallies. So seems like there's a compromise that we're waiting for.
Yeah, better the Rolling Stones should do it. grateful for their not singing. I'm just wondering, though, about these assurances from Mitch McConnell, because the fact is, he said he intended to bring this up as legislatively, and I don't know if it was a promise or how much they trust him, particularly in light of the fact that the tax reform bill, Jeff Flake was given a promise by Mitch McConnell, which wasn't fulfilled, and likewise Susan Collins of Maine, both Republican senators.
Yeah, you know, that's a really fair point and an interesting question, but I have to say, you know, I covered Congress for more than 10 years in Washington, and I will say that people trust Mitch McConnell a lot more than they trust President Trump right now. Even the Republicans don't trust President Trump in the same way. I mean, sort of a when you make this kind of handshake deal and you secure votes on something as important as opening the government, like probably he's going to at least allow for the debate. Now, what parameters that ends up taking, and is there a final bill, and is there any compromise, and could anything get through the House? I mean, I think those are all likely no's, but it's what the Democrats were asking for. And that's particularly relevant here in California, where Dianne Feinstein was under a lot of pressure from liberals to continue to say no to government funding until there's a deal on the STREAM Act, because it affects so many people here in California. She's got a primary challenge from the Senate leader, Kevin De Leon. So this alleviates some of that pressure, potentially. There are Democrats who would like to see her just say no, no matter what, and she might actually still vote no, because the Democrats are going to give the Republicans enough votes to move forward here, and they might not need her vote.
Let me go to Dan Schneider. President Trump's kind of MIA on all this, the dealmaker that he allegedly is, and I'm wondering about his role in all this, particularly in light of the fact that he sat down and presumably everything was love and we're going to work out a deal and I'll sign anything you put in front of me. And that was a bipartisan deal that was presented to him and then it didn't even move forward.
Well, and Trump has been sidelined, not by the opposition, but by his own allies, the Republicans in Congress, and in fact by his own staff. And, you know, Trump went to Washington promising, as you and your listeners know, to be a disruptor. And sometimes disrupting is good and sometimes it's bad. But in very intricate negotiations that require a very detailed knowledge of public policy, Trump's involvement has been more of a problem for Republicans than a benefit. And they've successfully convinced him, even though it's not where he would like to be, to stay on the sidelines and until they've resolved this. Interesting, just to follow up on Christina's point, and she knows this stuff better than just about anybody there is as recently as this morning, Senator Susan Collins, probably the last remaining Republican moderate in the Senate, said that McConnell's assurances about this agreement weren't strong enough. And I think it demonstrates that Chuck Schumer, the Democratic Senate leader, understands that even though Republicans by and large will get blamed for the shutdown, given their control over both White House and the Congress, he's got 10 Democratic incumbents representing states won by Donald Trump. And shutting down the government in those states in order to work out a deal on undocumented immigration is a political loser for them. Getting a promise for a debate and a vote as opposed to an outcome isn't a great hand for Schumer, but he's got to protect his incumbents, and it was probably the smart thing to do.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of blame going around. In fact, Senator Schumer said that talking to the president on this was like trying to come to some kind of reconciliation with Jell-O, or words to that effect. I thought when we're talking about the kind of division within the Republican Party, we'd hear a cut and get your comment on this, Dan. Lindsey Graham was expressing his frustration to reporters just yesterday about the difficulties he's had dealing with the White House during negotiations.
Every time we have a proposal, it is only yanked back by staff members. As long as Stephen Miller is in charge of negotiating immigration, we're going nowhere. He's been an outlier for years.
Called Stephen Miller an outlier, and this is kind of maybe not as harsh a word as some would use on this, but he has had the president's ear, and one, there's a suspicion that maybe he was the one that got to the president after all that talk about love.
Well, of all of Donald Trump's political relationships in Washington, the one between him and Lindsey Graham is probably the one most worthy of a Netflix series. You can remember during the 2016 campaign how harshly they went at each other. And Graham's worked very hard to develop a relationship with Trump. They go golfing regularly. He's become sort of a Trump whisperer. But no question, you can tell he's gotten very frustrated in recent days over the White House's inconsistency on immigration, which he believes, probably correctly, is being driven by Mr. Miller, the staffer.
Let me just go. I want to bring Christina Greer into this. Let me just go back for a moment to Christina Bellantoni, because Christina Bellantoni, there was so much electioneering going on when the government shut down, and presumably now that will at least for a few days be mellower. But the reality is that both sides were using it. And I just want to get your take on this, especially in light of the fact that there was a lot of blame about the Republicans having, you know, control of both houses and having the presidency, and therefore they are the ones who deserve the blame. But the pushback on that from the Republicans was you're not getting money to soldiers that they need. You're not getting money to all these different services that are in need of funding. And this is something that ought to be laid at the Democrats. The poll showed that most people agreed with the Democrats.
But it's way more complicated than that. I mean, even I actually kind of think of that Saturday Night Live sketch from this weekend, you know, nothing even really matters anymore, which obviously was more of a spoof on President Trump, kind of suggesting, you know, no matter what, he's still very popular with his conservative base. But, you know, think about the 2013 partial government shutdown. It lasted 17 days. You had all these workers furloughed. It cost the economy a lot, and Democrats were convinced that Republicans would be in huge trouble in the midterms the next year. And not only did they win a historic majority, the largest since before the Depression in the House, they also were able to win the Senate. And, you know, you just never know. We're not that far away from an election. That shutdown was much farther away from an election, more than a year. But then when you think about that actual blame, like the shorthand of that is that, well, Ted Cruz shut down the government over Obamacare, right? That's how people remember it. But there were a whole lot of Republicans that were willing to keep the government shut down much longer. The final deal angered a lot of Republicans on spending and other issues. And then, you know, the Democrats didn't cooperate either. So really, you can place blame in a lot of places. Whether there will be political consequences is all about sort of the framing. I mean, it does really matter how it's portrayed once there is a final deal. And I think you also have to get at that issue that they're just not kind of like the basic function of government is funding the government. And the fact that there's never, not never, but the fact that it's been a very long time since we've had longer term deals to give certainty to all of the agencies and all the people that rely on federal grant funding and all of that. I mean, that's blame for everybody there.
Well, in fact, since you mentioned Ted Cruz and the shutdown, the attempted shutdown over Obamacare, it's important to point out, I think, that President Obama saw to it that the military continue to get checks. And this is not meant in any partisan way, but Claire McCaskill actually put forth a resolution that was shot down by Mitch McConnell would do what essentially President Obama did, continuing to pay the military. I'm just mentioning that because people like Newt Gingrich who said, you know, holding servicemen hostage and the like. But let me go to Christina Greer, who again is a fellow at the NYU McSilver Institute and also associate professor of political science at Fordham. Her book is called Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Just a political question for you, Professor Greer. Is Mitch McConnell playing the Democrats here, as some would put it?
Well, I think the Democrats should be really wary of trusting Mitch McConnell just because he has reneged on so many promises in these past few months. I mean, I'm calling in from New York, and, you know, all New Yorkers know that Donald Trump is not to be trusted. His handshake means nothing, and, you know, his word means nothing, and he usually just goes with the last person in the room. Unfortunately for the Democrats, that last person tends to be Stephen Miller, and he undoes so many of the agreements that Trump's made with lots of people. I think what the Democrats are seeing, and what I think a lot of Democratic voters are quite worried about, is that McConnell is adopting some of these Trump tendencies to say one thing and actually not deliver when it comes to his word. And so some people really do fear that we'll have this, you know, stay where, you know, McConnell says we'll bring things to the floor and we'll actually have this discussion since Trump threw it to Congress. But as Christina B. said, you know, this is one of those situations where the voters want something, but I'm not exactly sure if the Democrats will be able to come through with the deal. And the framing of this is really important because the Republicans are already trying to say that it's the Democrats who are holding the country hostage. It's the Democrats who aren't patriotic and don't support our troops. But, you know, if you know anything about the three arms of government, you know, the Republicans control the executive and the legislative branches, and I might argue even the judicial branch. And so this is all them. I mean, this is the president who said, you know, during the election that he alone could fix it, and he has not fixed it. We have a government shutdown for the first time in modern history where one party controls both branches of government, and the government is not working. And it shows a little bit about Republican factions, but also this is an issue, immigration especially, is an issue that Democrats and Republicans have been fighting over for decades now. And so to think that we can have a resolution in 3 weeks is possibly a little unrealistic.
Well, is this also the president and those who are behind the president or those who are helping have his ear, so to speak, like Stephen Miller and Tom Cotton, are they also saying, we want the wall?
Well, I mean, I'm just going to be honest. This is a white supremacist agenda coming out of this particular administration. Okay, so this is about making sure that people of color from particular countries cannot come into the United States. The president's been pretty clear about that. Tom Cotton's been pretty clear about that. Stephen Miller in his 31, 32 years on this planet has been very clear about that as well. So you have various factions within the Republican Party, some people who argue that we have to think about some sort of comprehensive way of thinking about immigration. You have others who believe in a white supremacist agenda more in line with the president, which means we need to not only get rid of people of color who are already in the country, documented, not documented, dreamers, whatever they may be, but also make sure that we only have select people from particular, quote unquote, good countries. And you can read that as white countries, as the president so clearly stated when he's talking about Norway, right? Or Europe, Eastern European countries where he's gotten, you know, two of his three wives. So this is part of a larger conversation where we cannot dissect white supremacy from policy when it comes to this particular president and the people that he's chosen to surround himself with, like, and the Republicans who don't stick up for him or stick up to him when he starts going down the road of a very aggressive white supremacist agenda.
Let me get Dan Schneider's response to that thesis that you just put forward, especially in light of the fact that the Republican campaign apparatus was pretty much geared towards saying, if you allow the Dreamers to stay here, you're going to possibly, you know, have somebody killed, alluding to Kate Steinle, and then you, the Democrats, would be complicit in that murder or that death.
Well, probably better to be addressed in a little bit later in the show by Jonah Goldberg, but I would offer this. It's worth remembering that after the 2012 elections, the Republican Party infrastructure, such as it was, came to the realization and made a public announcement after some considerable study that in order for the party to survive, their words, not mine, that the party had to become much more expansive and much more accommodating and much more committed to immigration reform. Clearly, Trump's priorities flew in the face of that, and there's a considerable base of support for him in the country. The trick here, and you asked the professor specifically about the wall. Over the weekend, it's been reported, at least, that Senator Schumer agreed to funding for the wall in order to protect the Dreamers. Very, very strong immigration advocates like Congressman Gutierrez de Illinois has said, I hate this. He calls it hostage taking, but I'll fund the wall if that's what it takes to protect the Dreamers. And the real challenge for Senator Schumer here, and I think that's why we have the agreement that Christina told us about this morning, is he knows, Schumer knows, that roughly 90% of Americans support some kind of deal for the Dreamers. But he also knows that the majority of Americans don't want to shut down the government over it. And that leaves him with a very fine line to walk.
And what happens to the let me go to you on this, if I may, Christina B. Christina B. and Christina G. What happens to the Children's Health Insurance Program and all this? It's got an extension, too, but where does it play in?
We haven't seen, actually heard the details of, you know, said deal. All we know is that it's, you know, funding the government, and then apparently they'll get back to work. I mean, the House is supposed to be on recess this week, so how much of that will actually happen? You know, that is a program that everyone agrees needs more certainty than it has. And it's put another big undue burden on states. I shouldn't say undue burden. It's putting a burden on states trying to figure it out. Last year, they were playing politics with this, and they didn't know how long that funding would be. So this is a sort of a continual kicking the can down the road, which it sounds like I'm repeating myself. I mean, this is actually a big problem. And, you know, governments, particularly here in California, so many children are affected by this program. You know, you need to just have some semblance of what's going to happen going forward. And we don't know what that's going to look like yet.
Well, let me give the phone number out now and invite you, our listeners, to join us. And I remind you, we'll be talking to Jonah Goldberg later, but we want to hear from you. And if you have something you'd like to add to this discussion, whether question or comment, you can do that now by calling our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, please feel free to join us with your thoughts and questions or comments. Again, the number to call, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Interested to hear what you have to say about the shutdown. And we did get the word now that there has been a deal, and February 8th will be the marker for that. I'm also interested in hearing some thoughts from listeners and from Christina Greer about the marches that took place over this weekend and what effect they have on the body politic, or for that matter, on this present administration, because there were probably, about a million or more when you just add it all up, and talk about registering a million voters. How do you see it, Christina Greer?
Well, I think that this movement is picking up steam, and there's no way that you can stop this wave that's happening. You know, I think that there's been a lot of frustration with women across the country who have felt, A, that there's a sexual predator in the White House, B, that the sexual predator is being protected by his party and others, and C, they're now motivated to, you know, knock some of these people out of office, whether or not they're in their own party or you know, if they're a part of probably the Republican Party. I mean, the thing is, you know, in this country, voting is a two-stage process where you have to be registered and then you also have to vote. And I think registering so many people during these marches is incredibly important. You know, when you think about someone like Jesse Jackson, who ran for president in 84 and 88, he registered roughly 2 million people each time he ran for office. You know, many of those people were poor. Many of those people were African-American. And you're breeding a whole generation of voters by actually helping them register. And there are real barriers to registering and voting in this country, as we know. We've talked about it. It varies state to state. But I think, you know, we're going to see in a lot of these primaries and a lot of the general elections, there's been not just marching, but real education that's been going on, not just about hashtag Me Too, not just about, you know, sort of anti-Trump sentiments, but how do we really change policy in this country. You know, there seems to be a rollback not just on civil rights and voting rights and immigration rights, but also, you know, reproductive rights. And I think that that worries a lot of women and hopefully some men in this country where, you know, there's no such thing as women's issues. All issues are women's issues. Women manage money in their households. Women manage their children, their bodies, economic finance, you know, whatever it may be. So I think a lot of people have been inspired to get off of the sidelines. And really, if they don't feel like running themselves, to recognize that their $10 or their $15 to someone who isn't beholden to a corporate entity can actually make a difference, especially when you look at the numbers across the country. In a lot of these primaries, people are going to state houses with 10,000 votes. At least that happens in New York. It's pretty abysmal and it's pretty embarrassing. And so if you can actually mobilize a small group of people who are really passionate and care about these issues and care about getting rid of some of the men, especially who have either been sexual predators themselves or have just been lazy, inept, incompetent, and cashing a check that we pay for as taxpayers. I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised as women in May and June, when a lot of these states have primaries, and in September as well, but also in November, where there's a new crop of leadership that's coming through D.C., but especially in state houses. We can't forget that that's where the vast majority of policy and money is flowing through. You know, you think of a state like California, the budget's bigger than, you know, a lot of the countries across the globe. So hopefully women are paying attention to these, you know, in many ways, thankless positions in the state house and state senate. The real key is to really think about policy and the ways in which they can get people involved.
Let me get a quick response from you, Dan Schneider, as we come up on a break here.
The professor used one really important word, and that's motivation. We know through history that presidential elections are about persuading undecided voters. Midterms are about motivation. And there's no question that Democratic voters have a significant motivational edge heading into this year's midterms.
We're going to return. We're going to hear from Jonah Goldberg. We're also going to hear from you, our listeners. This is our Monday morning political roundup on Forum on KQED Public Radio. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking Monday morning political roundup, and we just had the breaking news at the top of this program that there has been a deal worked out, a temporary deal, which will go to February the 8th, and the government will continue presumably to operate until then. And Mitch McConnell has said that he will have every intention, I believe that's his language, to bring forth DACA and other things that are of major concern, particularly with respect to immigration. Jonah Goldberg joins us now. He's senior editor with the National Review and columnist for the LA Times and USA Today, and you can hear him often on NPR. And welcome, Jonah Goldberg. Do we have Jonah Goldberg?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay. For a minute, we didn't have you, but now we do. Glad to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome. Well, we want a conservative perspective, and we can certainly get it from you. What's your response to this deal that's worked out till February 8th?
I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I don't want to, like, traffic in sausage-making metaphors, because there are also cliched at this point, but this is, the whole thing has been quite ugly. I think that the Democrats were in a rough spot given the precedents that they had set in previous shutdowns. They were being asked to vote on a budget resolution that had nothing they opposed in it, which they tried to sort of force the issue of DACA and immigration onto it. And I just don't think the optics of that were that great. They were good for their base, but I don't think they were great for anybody else. And at the same time, I think, you know, I think it's clear that Donald Trump made this whole process more difficult. I have some, I rarely say this, but I have some sympathy for Chuck Schumer when he says negotiating with Trump is like negotiating with Jell-O, even if he mangled the phrase. You know, it's entirely possible that, you know, you'll ask me to come on to talk about the next budget shutdown in February.
Well, I do anticipate there will be another shutdown in February.
I don't anticipate it, but I don't rule it out either. The part of the problem is, you know, that Lindsey Graham, for all the talk about Lindsey, and I actually like Lindsey Graham. I'm sort of an outlier among a lot of my conservative friends on this, as with quite a few other things these days. But the problem is that everyone wants to talk about how what Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin were doing was crafting a bipartisan approach to immigration. What they leave out is that while Lindsey Graham may very well be a conservative on issues like defense and taxes and other issues, when it comes to immigration, he's much more in lockstep with the Democrats and much more out of touch with his own base. A real bipartisan move would have been something crafted between Tom Cotton and Dick Durbin, because Cotton is much more in the mainstream of where the Republican Party is these days on issues like immigration. And no deal that Graham was pushing could get past Donald Trump's desk so long as Stephen Miller, the White House aide who is sort of has the immigration portfolio, was on duty as the lifeguard. And you heard, you know, Lindsey Graham expressing his frustration with that fact. But I think for the foreseeable future, it's a fact.
We do have a cut here, and I'd like your response to this, Jonah Goldberg. We're going to get a cut up here in a moment of Senator Chuck Schumer just moments ago on the Senate floor, where he actually announced the deal to end the shutdown. And let's hear.
My recent offer to the president was a generous one. I put his signature campaign issue on the table in exchange for DACA, and still he turned away. President Trump's unwillingness to compromise caused the Trump shutdown and brought us to this moment. The facts are well known.
Well, there it is, Jonah Goldberg. The culpability, at least from Senator Schumer, is President Trump.
Yeah, no, I get the politics of that. And I think everybody, you know, the politics of shutdowns are always to encourage both sides to seem like they're the reasonable ones and the other side is the unreasonable one. And when you control all three branches of government and you're actually not putting poison pills into a continuing resolution to fund the government, it's very difficult to argue, as the Democrats did, very much like Ted Cruz did in 2013, that they're the ones who are taking the reasonable position, even if you agree with them on DACA. And I think, you know, the miscalculation was, most Americans would like to do something to help the DACA kids, even if a lot of them aren't kids anymore. I think one of the problems that we get into is most people tune out a lot of the details. I don't know who's telling the truth. Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, says that Chuck Schumer promised authorization, which in budget terms is not the same thing as funding the wall. Chuck Schumer says he did. It's entirely possible that Chuck Schumer is telling the truth, because Donald Trump has agreed to all sorts of things, at least in meetings, that he then had to recant, because he kind of has a condo salesman's approach to deal making, and he tells people whatever they want to hear. At the same time, I think the real, and I'm writing a column about this, so it's in my head, but I think one of the main problems is that the wall itself is a politically bad sticking point for the president. There are a lot of other things that they could be doing that most of the serious immigration restrictionists I talk to would prefer, like making e-verify mandatory. That would be cheaper by orders of magnitude than a wall, which will take years to build and cost a great deal. But Donald Trump is so locked into this, the politics of the wall, that he can't let go of it. And I think that that's, you know, it's too late now. He promised it 10,000 different ways, and it's sort of bound up with his persona. But everyone's talking about how, you know, we need more Nixon to China moments. A real Nixon to China moment would be for Donald Trump to say, hey, look, the wall, I wasn't in favor of the wall, but there are things we can do right now that would help with illegal immigration that are cheaper and faster and better. So in exchange for DACA, in exchange for postponing the wall, we're going to go with mandatory E-Verify and some of those sorts of things. And I think he would get a lot of cover from a lot of the sort of anti-immigration hawks. I'm not quite one of them, because they would prefer that. But politically and optically, he just can't be seen as backing down on the wall, because everyone said he was stupid for proposing it in the first place, and he doesn't want to give into that narrative.
Yeah, I read an article you did where you mentioned the E-Verify, and also said you should probably somehow, I don't know how you do this exactly, maybe extract a promise from those DACA recipients who somehow were not deported that they wouldn't try to get others here from their home countries and that sort of thing. But when Senator Schumer comes out and literally points his finger and says, this is President Trump is to blame for not willing to compromise, you have to go back to that meeting where he said, everything is love here and I'll sign anything you put in front of me.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get me to defend Donald Trump and how he does these negotiations, because I think it's not very good. You know, in his book, The Art of the Deal, he brags about, you know, betraying or going back on promises and reneging on commitments. And that might work in the zero-sum world of Manhattan real estate. But in politics, it's much more difficult, because there are no dotted lines you sign on until you pass legislation. Until then, it's all handshakes and good faith and verbal agreements. And I think that he gets himself into trouble because he tells people what they want to hear, and then because he doesn't know the details of immigration policy, he overpromises things that he can't possibly deliver without having people like Ann Coulter set themselves on fire.
Jonah Goldberg, senior editor of National Review, columnist for the LA Times and USA Today. Thank you for joining us, Jonah Goldberg.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And let me read some comments that are coming in. What are your phone calls? Jesse writes, as a fellow Democrat, I would assume responsibility for the government shutdown. Don't blame anyone else. In fighting for justice, we should own our power. And Charles tweets, Tom Cotton is not mainstream. He is an extremist who wants legal immigration cut in half. Most Americans want more immigrants. Well, you can join us again by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or tweeting us, Twitter handle @kqed.org. And let me go to our callers, and let's begin with Gil. Gil, you're on.
You know, I'm a Latino Democrat who supported immigration issues for decades, and a lot of us believe that there's an attempt to give away the farm when the House elections are about to happen at the end of the year. We'll have a Democratic House, and the deals will be completely different then. The national Republicans want things like chain migration removed and merit supported and a 50% cut in legal immigration. We believe this is a pullback from ourselves as a nation that supports the Statue of Liberty and us being a nation of immigrants.
Thank you for that call. Dan Schneider, you want to respond?
Well, I think the caller makes an excellent political point. As we talked about earlier, the energy and the motivation heading into these midterm elections is clearly on the Democratic side. You see it at the marches. You see it in the number of Republican House members who are retiring. You see it on any number of fronts. The challenge here, particularly with the DACA debate, is it's not just a political consideration. As all of your listeners know, there are real-world considerations to this deadline. And Schumer and the Democratic leadership understands that as the minority party in Congress, from now until next January at least, the only leverage they have to get a Dreamer deal through is as part of an overall budget agreement. Otherwise, minority parties can't pass legislation. And so when McConnell promises a discussion about immigration reform, Schumer still has to figure out how to get 51, if not 60 votes, to vote for a DACA fix. So the political winds are heading in the Democratic figures. But if you're a young dreamer, November isn't soon enough.
Well, and President Trump did raise the specter this past weekend that maybe we should get rid of the filibuster. That would solve a number of problems from his perspective, I guess. Let me get another caller on here, and that's you, Jeff. Join us.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. You know, I was just real happy to hear the issue of race brought up and, you know, just how race.
I don't know what happened to that caller, but Christina Greer, I think he was trying to say that's an issue that really needs to be addressed. And yet there's a lot of frustration with having it addressed with this particular administration, to put it mildly.
Well, yeah, well, this is, you know, an administration that, you know, we have not seen a white supremacist president in quite some time. And we've had them in the past, but definitely not in the latter 20th, early 21st century. We also haven't seen a president who's just so excited to be ignorant about the issues. I think that that really scares a lot of people, especially because his base, you know, sort of the people who are calling for the wall, who really, you know, these are the people who are good people on both sides, right, who are carrying the Confederate flag, who are saying that Jews won't replace us, who feel like immigrants are all illegal immigrants, which just isn't the case. We are a nation of immigrants. Donald Trump's mother was an immigrant. His paternal grandfather was an immigrant. His wife, number one and number three, are immigrants.
Excuse me, from countries like Norway, I mean Scotland and Germany.
Yeah. And he has a very particular view. And this isn't since he moved into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. For those of us who are in New York, we know that he has a four-decade history of going against people of color. He was sued by the Nixon administration, he and his father, for, you know, racial discrimination. We know that he took out the full-page ad about the Central Park Five and never apologized. We know that he essentially trolled President Obama for 8 years and the birther stuff. I mean, the list goes on and on. And since he stepped into the presidency, we can start with the Muslim ban. We can start with widow Maisha Johnson. We can talk about John Lewis and saying that he's all talk, no action. We can talk about the NFL and patriotism and lack thereof. I mean, we have the receipts. And so to have these conversations about immigration and policy without really thinking explicitly about race, racism, and white supremacy, we're not really having the conversation. This is a man who brought Steve Bannon and Breitbart into the White House. If you've ever read any comments on Breitbart, you know that this is the worst of the worst that this country has. And so I think it's really important that we don't get so involved in sort of speaking about policy in general terms without really making it clear. If you are supporting this particular administration, you have to ask yourself, what types of white supremacist notions are you subscribing to with this particular president? And that's just plain as day. He's made it plain as day, and he wants it to be that way. This isn't the first time that America's had racist immigration policies. We can look at the 1924 Chinese Exclusion Act. We can look at lots of immigration policies that have been less than forthcoming. But since the 1965 Immigration Act, when Lyndon Baines Johnson convinced Congress that immigration from the Caribbean, from Africa, from Asia is actually a really good thing, we've actually been moving towards a much more robust conversation. Even Bob Dole and Ronald Reagan talked about sort of creating a pathway to make sure that citizens could work here because they recognized that they were paying taxes. You look at the data right now that just came out. The people who are committing terrorism are not people. You know, yes, you have some outliers here and there, but the vast majority of terrorism that we've experienced in the past few years has been domestic terrorism from white American homegrown terrorists who are actually terrorizing other Americans of color or immigrants of color. So this is the news that Donald Trump and his ilk are creating, quite honestly, is a false narrative. It is fake news, but he's marketing it as such that this is the way America is going, and it's just not true. And I think that's the piece that we really have to fight back at the polls, but in this counteracting policy space where we need to make sure that that we have to cut off Donald Trump and state houses and court cases when we can't and be very vigilant and active.
I Danchner wanted to respond here.
Yeah, what I think the professor's done extraordinarily well is outline the challenge for the Democratic Party going into this year's midterm elections. She articulated almost the perfect inspirational message to motivate a Democratic base heading into the midterms, and we talked about earlier, that's what you need to win in the midterms. That said, if you talk about the swing voters, the voters the particularly white working class voters in Great Plains and Midwestern states who switched over to vote for Trump in 2016, they will respond in all likelihood, and this is the Democratic challenge, to messages about factory openings to manufacturing and job opportunities, as opposed to a message about white supremacy. So I'm not arguing with the professor's message at all, but simply pointing out that while it serves a tremendous service to the Democratic Party to motivate their most loyal and committed base, the Democrats do have to find a way to balance to reach out to those voters who they lost to Trump in the 2016 election.
I'm going to read a comment from John who writes,
I say ignore them. They're gone. You know, they may be gone temporarily or gone forever. But you know what? Democrats actually have a real opportunity to get new people to come into the base. It's hard. It's difficult. It costs money. But I think the problem with Democrats is for far too many elections, they've been chasing the white male, quote unquote, working class voter. And they've defined that as the ideal Democrat that should come back to the party. You know what? They left. Forget them. Let's focus on Black, Latino, female, Asian, you know, demographics that actually see this as a white supremacist narrative in this particular party that's in power. And every voter you've ever surveyed, their number one issue is the economy and jobs. It doesn't matter. It's not immigration. It's not racial issues. Everybody needs a good job and a good economy. So the Democrats, if they come up with a strategy, which I have not seen just yet out of Tom Perez and the DNC, but if the Democrats can actually come up with a fiscal strategy to actually counteract the inadequacy of this particular administration, I think that they have a good shot. And we can stop catering to the white male Democratic voter that's left the party the way sort of the New York Times is obsessed with. And let's focus on who you have. Like, love the one you're with.
Let me actually go to Christina Bellantoni on this, because first I wanted to read a comment from John who says, holding the entire government hostage over partisan interests has now become the status quo. How can we expect this to change? The only budget that should lose funding if representatives refuse to compromise is the one that funds their own paychecks. I'm interested, Christina B., in going to you again, because this whole question that's been brought up between Christina Greer and Dan Schnur has to do with who are going to vote and who the turnout is going to represent demographically. Is the Dreamers in the DACA? This isn't discussed much, but you know, you've got 700,000 people who could turn in as citizens, most of them potentially Democratic voters, right? Isn't that a piece of this whole puzzle?
Well, it could be. I mean, you definitely hear Republicans talk about that. I mean, one thing that one of the many reasons I was surprised by Trump's victory in the 2016 election is that I actually was looking at the record numbers of people that were going to naturalization ceremonies, people that had been eligible to become citizens and vote for a long time and were finally making that choice before the fall elections. I thought, for me, that signaled a surge of anti-Trump sentiment. And I was wrong in that particular case. But, you know, yeah, this is an issue. And that's one of the reasons Republicans, I think, in general, have been trying to look at what they can do to remake their party and to reach out to others, because the demographics of this country are changing. And even in the latest USC Los Angeles Times poll, which came out Friday morning, you know, we're showing that the strongest Republican base is with older white men still. And that is something that the Republican Party cannot build a sustainable future on. It might work for the next few elections, or it might totally change the tide when it comes to this fall. I mean, there's a great piece by Rebecca Traister in New York Magazine looking at the record numbers of female candidates running. That doesn't mean that they are going to win. Certainly, there are actually some, like Mimi Walters, for example, if she is one of the Republicans to lose in California, that's one fewer female in the California delegation. Now, there are a lot of female candidates running here, but there's also big, wide-open top two primaries. So we don't really know how those numbers are going to shake out when it comes to Congress, but we know that there is a movement in particular of energized non-white men out there that tend to prefer Democrats.
Is there someone in the horizon as far as Democratic leadership, though, that could essentially capture the kind of constituency that Christina Greer is talking about? I mean, you know, you've heard names like Kamala Harris, you've heard Cory Booker and so forth.
I've heard them. I mean, at least in the Senate, I think that Harry Reid, before he left, he was pretty careful about elevating people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders who could tap into that. Kamala Harris is definitely looked at as someone that is commanding a lot of attention. Booker's involved. Amy Klobuchar, right, the non-traditional face. But on the House side, this continues to be an issue for Nancy Pelosi, who, you know, she's made every indication that if they win back the House, she will seek the speakership again. And that is something that energizes Republicans because they like to run against her. And it also tells this entire crop of, you know, sort of, it's like being a mid-level career in Congress. It's like if you're between 40 and 60, that's like mid-level politics. And a lot of very ambitious Democrats are thinking, why am I waiting around for this? When is it going to be my opportunity to lead? And most of those people are not your traditional faces.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Christina Bellantoni of the Los Angeles Times, with Christina Greer from NYU McSilver Institute, and with Dan Schnur, who's here with us in studio, professor with the Annenberg School of Communications at USC and UC Berkeley, former Republican strategist, now a registered independent. We also spoke with Jonah Goldberg, and we appreciate, of course, your support for KQED. This is a fundraising period. For more information about how to support us, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another phone call. Let me get Wynn on next. Wynn, you're on.
Thanks. For a few years, the Senate has been operating under this reconciliation rule, I guess, which allows them to do major votes with 50 votes. And then we have the nuclear option that's around all the time. And we have the normal rules of 60 votes that the Senate needs for normal operation. So what rules are the Senate operating under nowadays, or not operating, as the case may be? And how is it going to go forward for the next 3 years?
Okay. Can I go to you on this again, Christina Bellantoni?
You sure can. But the answer is, I don't know, right? This is like such a outside the norm way of functioning in your government that it is really difficult to see how it's going to play out. And, you know, don't forget, I mean, this kind of sounds silly, but like, President Trump is going to Davos this week, you know, assuming a shutdown is ended today. And that could end up being an entirely different conversation that lead people to believe an entirely different set of values about him. And then he comes back to the U.S. and then how does that conversation go forward? I mean, this is someone that, you know, as Dan pointed out and as Jonah pointed out, like, has definitely said different things to different types of people.
Let me thank Wynn for the call. We'll go right to another caller. And let's go to you, John. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. A question for Professor Greer. You know, a lot of us sympathize with what you're saying, but those of us who remember the 1986 amnesty for illegal immigrants remember a very different chapter in the Democratic Party's history. The Democratic Party was solidly against illegal immigration. If you recall, in the 1990s, the great African-American Congresswoman Barbara Jordan from Texas headed up the commission, and she took a very, what today would be called, a hard line against illegal immigration. My question for you, Professor Greer, is what do you think has happened to the Democratic Party to move away from the zero tolerance for illegal immigration policy, which I'm sure you're aware hits unskilled African Americans hardest of all the groups in our society? It's been a disaster for them. Why has the Democratic Party moved away from the no tolerance for illegal immigration policy that Barbara Jordan advocated in the 90s? And what, if anything, can we as Democrats do to get back to this policy that supports our native-born, unskilled, working-class fellow citizens?
Christina Greer.
Yeah, well, I think we have to look at the evolution of a party over the course of 25 years. I mean, you know, the Republican Party is completely unrecognizable right now as well. And so I think as the Democrats realize realistically that they, you know, they need to be more inclusive of Latinos and Asians, and also, quite frankly, they take African Americans for granted at the polls. We have seen that time and time again, especially when it comes to the black female voter. But I think also, you know, where are African-American voters supposed to go? I mean, you have to cast your lot with a party who at least is going to have some semblance of thought towards you as a group. So, yes, some of these policies may adversely affect African-Americans. But, you know, I think a lot of black voters are quite savvy and they're not falling for this sort of I should be against immigrants because they steal jobs. Rich people steal jobs. They're the ones, you know, when we say Republicans are retiring in 2018, they're not retiring. They're cashing out. They got the tax bill, and they're going to make tons more money with private corporations that they've actually helped to solidify and create this larger gap of wealth inequality. So I think to say, yes, the economy has definitely always hurt African-Americans the most, but to say that African-Americans should quasi-naturally be against immigration, legal or undocumented. First of all, I don't use the term illegal immigration. Technically, we're all illegal immigrants if you ask any Native Americans in this country. So I do think that that's just a cheap shortcut to kind of create this racialized division where, yes, in some communities it's real. However, the people who are actually creating this inequality, it's not working class Latinos. It's not working class Black people. It's people like Donald Trump and his ilk and his party members who are passing legislation to make sure that a very small percentage of white Americans maintains their economic prowess as they always have in this country.
Michael, if I can quickly, there's a considerable amount of public opinion polling that shows that relatively few voters have shifted their opinions on this issue over the years. The reason public opinion polling and the broader political shifts that the caller talks about have taken place is primarily generational. If you look at young people, not just young Latino and young Asian voters, but young African Americans and young Caucasians, because they've grown up in much more multicultural, demographically diverse societies, they don't harbor the same type of suspicions toward newcomers from other countries as their parents and grandparents did. That's why the change is happening.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you, Dan Schnur. Dan Schnur again with us in studio, professor at the Annenberg School of Communications, USC and UC Berkeley. Thank you, Christina Greer, fellow with NYU McSilver Institute, her book, Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. And thanks to Christina Bellantoni, assistant managing editor for politics with the LA Times. We also spoke with Jonah Goldberg, senior editor of the National Review. When we return, we're going to talk with Richard Haass, head of the Council of Foreign Relations, and lots to talk about there, too. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.